I'm Christopher Lydon with the poet Christian Wyman, whose work, though he didn't plan it this way, is now entwined with his grave illness and with his engagement with faith and God. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one extends our series of readings and interviews with contemporary poets. Whose words these are is the title of the series. The notion is that our poets might just be the best authorities out there on what we're all going through. Christian Wyman grew up colorfully, dramatically, as we'll hear, in West Texas. He has traveled the world, lived all over the place. He's based now in Chicago as the editor of the ever-evolving, ever-provocative poetry magazine. Christian Wyman, welcome. Would you give us, for a start, a signature poem out of this new book, Every Ribbon Thing?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Christopher. It's a little difficult to pick a signature poem as I think of this book as containing so many different tones. It was, that's accidental. It wasn't something I did purposefully, but I did have a lot of different tones come together in a short period of time, and the book tries to balance these or maybe put them together in fragmented ways. But here's a poem called For D, and D is my wife. It's a short little poem. Groans going all the way up a young tree, half cracked and caught in the crook of another. Pause. All around the hill-ringed, heavened pond, leaves shush themselves like an audience. A cellular stillness, as of some huge attention bearing down. May I hold your hand? A clutch of mayflies banqueting on oblivion writhes above the water like visible light. And I guess the reason I start with that poem is because it seems to me to both isolate a moment of eternity, even as it acknowledges that that moment cannot be isolated. And I think a lot of this book exists on that crux.
May I react quickly?
Sure.
The poem begins with groans and it ends with visible light, which reminds me first of the prayer of St. Francis, which ends with may we be a light in this world, but also the death of Ivan Illich, which ends with this expanding circle of light in Tolstoy's great short story about a man facing death. I think your wife must be very grateful.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. It's taken me a long time to find a poetry of intimacy. I don't always value that above other kinds of poetry. I think there are all kinds of different poetries, and I like I like the full range of poetry.
There's so many intense formal poems at the end of this book, but I wish you'd start maybe earlier on with maybe Five Houses Down or some of those evocations of other places.
Sure. This poem, Five Houses Down, it comes right out of my childhood. And I grew up in far west Texas, a small town of about 10,000 people called Snyder. And my whole family had come from that area, and they were around there. They're still in that area. No one has left. I'm the only one who's left. And there's nothing really to know in advance except maybe the word sapper in this poem. A sapper is a person who goes out and diffuses bombs. Five houses down. I loved his tin, demented chickens and the hell-eyed dog, the mailbox shaped like a huge green gun. I loved the eyesore opulence of his five partial cars, the wonder-cluttered porch with its oil spill plumage, tools called in oil, the dark clockwork of disassembled engines, christened sweet baby and benedicted old bitch. and down the steps into the yard the explosion of mismatched parts and black scraps, amid which, like a bad sapper cloaked in luck, he would look up stunned, patting the gut that slopped out of his undershirt and saying, "Son, you looking to make some scratch?" All afternoon we'd pile the flatbed high with stacks of Exxon floor mats mysteriously stenciled with his name, rain-rotted sheetrock, or miles of misfitted pipes, coil after coil of rusted fence wire that stained for days every crease of me, rollicking it all to the dump where, while he called every rag man and ravined junk dog by name, he cat-picked the avalanche of trash and fished some always fixable thing up from the depths. His endless, aimless work was not work, my father said. His bark-like earthquake curses were not curses, for he could goddamn a slipped wrench and shit-fuck a stuck latch, but one bad word from me made his whole being twang like a nail misstruck. Ain't no call for that, son, no call at all. Slipknot, what knot, knot from which no man escapes, prestoed back to plain old rope. Whip snake, black snake, deep in the worm dirt, worms like the clutch of mud. I wanted to live forever, five houses down in the womanless rooms a woman sometimes seemed to move through, leaving him twisting a hand-stitched dish towel or idly wiping the volcanic dust. It was heaven to me. Beans and weenies from paper plates, black-fingered tinkerings on the back stoop as the sun set, on an upturned fruit crate a little jam jar of rye like ancient light, from which, once, I took a single secret sip, my eyes tearing and my throat on fire.
That's a whole boyhood.
Yeah, it really is. It is a whole boy. It's a whole adulthood too. You know, it's really an ars poetica. It's about how one comes to write poetry. At least how this person came to write poetry, and it wasn't out of books. Oddly enough, I mean, I think my own experience was I grew up in a culture without books. There were no books in my house, and I grew up with the notion of in a world of things, and an attachment to things, and a love of things, and I'm very moved by poets like Seamus Heaney, the Scottish poet George Mackay Brown, who have such a command of language that they can make the things of the world seem almost palpable in their words. You know, you can almost feel that their presence in the poem. That seems to me a very magical effect. And that was my childhood, is a world of things.
Nothing but in things, said William Carlos Williams.
Exactly, yeah.
But you also, there's a density of language which sounds a lot like Seamus Heaney, that slipknot, whatnot, these are hard lines to read, and you couldn't read them quickly. You read them beautifully.
Yeah, I think the poem makes you slow down, and you know, it's meant to have some of that clutter that this man lives among, you know, some of that eyesore opulence and the wonder-cluttered porch, as I put it on the first page. So the poem is meant to make you slow down.
Rain-rotted sheetrock or miles of misfitted pipes, yeah. So how did this boy in a bookless home become a poet? Who told you you could? Who told you you had to?
You know, I don't know. Someone asked me that the other day. I have no epiphany to share. You know, Wordsworth had his great epiphany where he suddenly realized that he was a poet and consecrated his life to poetry forever, but I have nothing like that. I feel more like Patrick Kavanaugh, who talked about dabbling in verses until they'd become a life. I did set out to be a poet at one point in my life when I was, you know, leaving college, but it feels very much to me sort of ad hoc and generated by chance, and and also not complete. I still feel, like right now, I haven't written a poem in months, and it feels to me very much like I'm not a poet, in fact. And so I think it's very much a process of becoming, one that I have not reached the end of.
Hmm. Were the poems who made you say, you know, that I can do?
That I can point to. You know, I got this great fellowship when I was in college, and I went over to Oxford for the summer, and to me it was a revelation just because I had not had that kind of intellectual experience at all. And so I loved that, meeting with the tutor and everything, but in fact what I discovered was on my own. I came across in a bookshop one day the selected poems of Yeats and Eliot, and they were in an edition together, and a very small book, and I sat there and read one afternoon, and I hadn't read either one of them before, and to me it was magical, and I didn't understand what I was reading, which is still often the case now. I don't understand something that I love at first, and I didn't understand what I was reading at all, but I knew that I loved the music so much, and also that it seemed to speak so deeply to something in my soul, something that I wanted to answer. And so definitely those two poets, they set something going in me.
Christian Wyman, give us another or two or three of those poems in the new book that people love to hear.
Let me give you one. I'll give you a couple of very different poems. Here's one set in Chicago. I don't think this poem really needs any setup, other than maybe it'll help if I just say that it's the scene is I'm sitting inside with my dog watching the neighborhood come to life.
Hmm.
It's called It Takes Particular Clicks. Flip-flops, leash clinks, spit on the concrete like a light slap. Our dawn goon ambles past, flexing his pit bull. And soft, and soon, a low burn lights the flight path from O'Hare. Slowly the sky, a roaring flue to heaven, slowly shut. Here's a curse for a car door stuck for the umpteenth time. Here a rake for next door's nut to claw and claw at nothing. My nature is to make of the speed bump scraping the speeder's undercarriage and the ohm of traffic, and somewhere the helicopter hovering over snarls, a kind of clockwork from which all things seek release. But it takes particular clicks to pique my poodle's interest, naming with her nose's particular quiver the unseeable, unsayable squirrel. Good girl. I guess this is what I mean about balancing tones. You know, this book contains a lot of darkness, and it contains a lot of darkness because I have an illness. It contains a lot of darkness because many of the poems are fraught with the kind of religious anguish. But I think some of the poems, and what relieved me enormously is in writing this book, was the lightness that gets into a lot of the poems. And this is an example of it, because it is about my nature to make things into a kind of clockwork comprehensibility, whereas my lovely poodle she needs something very particular to make her pay attention, and I think she maybe has the right idea. I might contrast that with this title poem, Every Riven Thing. And this poem sounds like it's a villanelle, but in fact it's just an invented form. It takes the first line, and that's the same first line of every stanza, but it breaks it up in different places to change the meaning in every instance.
It keeps repunctuating it.
Exactly, yeah. Keeps repunctuating the line to change the meaning.
Yeah.
Every riven thing. God goes, belonging to every riven thing he's made, sing his being simply by being the thing it is. Stone and tree and sky, man who sees and sings and wonders why God goes. belonging to every riven thing he's made, means a storm of peace. Think of the atoms inside the stone. Think of the man who sits alone, trying to will himself into a stillness where God goes belonging. To every riven thing he's made, there is given one shade, shaped exactly to the thing itself. Under the tree, a darker tree. Under the man, the only man to see, God goes belonging to every riven thing. He's made the things that bring him near, made the mind that makes him go. A part of what man knows, a part from what man knows, God goes belonging to every riven thing he's made. This is one of those poems that came to me as pure gift. I don't mean to make special claims for the poem, but in terms of the ease with which it was written, it was over and done with in an hour, I think. And it contains all these complicated structures, and to me it seemed to me a pure gift in my life.
Define riven. A riven thing as opposed to a given thing or any other.
Yeah, riven. Riven, of course, means broken. Mm. It means shattered or broken or wounded or unhealed. And I think that notion is very important to me in my notion of God and of religion, is the notion of brokenness, that we are broken creatures, very broken creatures. And I don't think of God as necessarily healing that brokenness as much as I do as participating in it.
Mm. I'm glad we've got God in the picture, and he'll be back. But I wonder, would you read a poem that I'm still puzzling about called After the Diagnosis, which immediately evokes your illness, but it doesn't deal with it quite head on?
Yeah, I think a lot of these poems in this book seem to be about illness, but then they're inflected in particular ways, or they're often not exactly my illness. You know, I've had all these experiences that have brought me into contact with other people and other people's illnesses. There's a poem in here called The Mole, which is about skin cancer. I definitely don't have skin cancer, I think that's the way poetry works, that often your own autobiographical experience will be the seed of something that grows into something quite different. This poem is very mysterious to me because 5.5 years ago I got a diagnosis of very rare cancer, and it was a terrible diagnosis. I had just gotten married, and it's incurable. And so it's just something that I live with. But the strange thing, and this is another one of those ways in which poetry seems to me miraculous and inexplicable, is that a lot of this poem After the Diagnosis was written before I got the diagnosis. And I had been working and working. This is not a poem that came easy. I had been working and working on this poem and was unable to finish it. And I would say I'd been working on it for a year. And then I got the diagnosis, and then I finished it immediately. And so there's some mystery there in which my body was feeling what was happening and working towards an expression of it, but the reality wasn't there yet, or the reality was there, but I couldn't perceive it yet. After the diagnosis. No remembering now when the apple sapling was blown almost out of the ground. No telling how, with all the other trees around, it alone was struck. It must have been luck, he thought for years, so close to the house it grew. It must have been night. Change is a thing one sleeps through when young, and he was young. If there was a weakness in the earth, a give, he went down on his knees to find and feel the limits of. There is no longer. If there was one random blow from above, the way he's come to know from years in this place, the roots were stronger. Whatever the case, he has watched this tree survive wind ripping at his roof for nights on end, heats and blights that left little else alive. No remembering now. A day's changes mean all to him, and all days come down to one clear pane through which he sees among all the other trees this leaning, clenched, unyielding one that seems cast in the form of a blast that would have killed it, as if something at the heart of things, and with the heart of things, had willed it.
Wow, which was the part that came late?
The end. The end. I couldn't finish the poem until after the diagnosis, and I think it is actually an expression of deep hope and an expression of despair. You know, Auden talks about poetry as being the clear expression of mixed feelings. and that's maybe what this poem is. You know, so that even a word like unyielding at the end, this leaning, clenched, unyielding one, is complicated because unyielding can mean not giving up, but it can also mean not bringing forth yield. In terms of a tree, it doesn't bring forth fruit. And so I think this poem is perched right on that edge of meaning and hope, and then of suffering and despair.
But even before the diagnosis, there was this anticipation somehow of a tree being blown out of its setting.
Right. And like I say, I believe in poetry I believe poetry has prophetic powers. Mm. I believe what is that? Those lovely lines from Frost. Oh, should a child be left unwarned that any song in which he mourned would be as if he prophesied. It were unworthy of the tongue to let the half of life alone and play the good without the ill, and yet 'twould seem that what is sung in happy sadness by the young, fate has no choice but to fulfill. Those are devastating lines from a late poem by Frost, and they suggest some of the prophetic powers of poetry, and you better not mess around with it.
Yeah. I'm so glad you mentioned Frost, because there's something of Frost in your vernacular rhythm, very kind of homey sound. But the general question I'd ask you would be, where did you find yourself fitting into the voice of American poetry, and who did you connect with?
Certainly Frost. I think you're right to pick up on that. I mean, this poem, After the Diagnosis, is almost an homage to Frost. And there's another one I wrote in my first book called Clearing, which is very clearly an homage to Frost. And he's been very important to me. But gosh, there have been others, and not all Americans. Seamus Heaney was very important to me. Virgil was very important to me in learning how to Robert Fitzgerald's translation of Virgil, learning how to write a certain kind of balanced blank verse line early on, which I eventually moved away from, but it helped me to learn a lot about balance and integrity of lines.
Fascinating. I ask so many poets, I mean, where do you see yourself in this great chain of being, going back to Shakespeare, I suppose to Homer, I mean, and in America today? That's especially a question for the editor of Poetry Magazine.
Yeah, I don't feel any obligation to set myself in a tradition or to see myself in a tradition. I don't, you know, maybe the poems are, I mean, I obviously I hope like hell like that some of them last. I hope that, well, my hope is what Frost hoped, that a few of the poems are, people will want them stuck in their heads for a while. They won't be able to get rid of them. Obviously, I want that, but I don't feel any anxiety about fitting into the tradition or my work being lost. If it's all lost, then that's just the way it should be. So I don't really, you know, I don't feel that. And I also don't feel any great sense of partisanship in terms of where my work fits in within the American poetic landscape, because there are so many poets who would seemingly write so differently than I do, and yet I've loved their work and learned an enormous amount from them. James Schuyler comes immediately to mind. He's a poet that I love, and yet I could never do anything that he does, that kind of buoyancy and his ability to shift gears so seamlessly that there don't seem to be any gears. If I tried to write like him, I would just be lurching all over the road. And so I learn from people like that. Ann Carson is another. I absolutely love her poem, The Glass Essay, and to a lesser degree, Autobiography of Red. But The Glass Essay, I think, is a great poem of the 20th century, and yet I could never do anything quite like that. And so I'm happy to come across these things that don't necessarily fit within my poetic compass, and yet I can just enjoy them.
I wonder who every poet's conversation is with. I mean, who are you writing for? Is it the subscriber list of Poetry Magazine? Is it your aunts and uncles or nieces and nephews or teachers or other poets or what?
No, I have no sense of an audience. I mean, my responsibility when I'm writing a poem, I guess I feel only responsible to that music that's in my head and to getting it out of my head, finding some way of getting it out of my head. And I don't feel any responsibility to an audience. If the poem, I do try to be clear. I mean, I try to make the poems as clear as possible. I'm not happy when, people find them too difficult. And yet, that said, my first responsibility is to that music that's in my head. And so I don't have any sense of writing for an audience or the subscriber list of Poetry Magazine or my family. There was a time when I wanted to write poems that my family could read, and it's evident in my first book. But that's not the case any longer.
Christian Wyman, I wonder if you'd read from some of the later sections of this new book, Every Riven Thing, in which God is a major player, death and disease are sort of part of the agenda. I don't know where is to begin exactly.
Well, let me read a couple of these poems in which you might think of them in contrast to that title poem, Every Riven Thing, because I went through a period where it seemed to me that I was given poems as gifts and I was given access to spiritual experience, to my own soul, in poetry. And belief seemed to me clear in ways that I don't experience it in my life. And belief is very muddled, and I think of my own spiritual life as being very muddled. But there was a while there when the poems I wrote seemed to me to be very clear expressions of what to me seemed credible belief. And then I found myself writing some other poems which they were disturbing to me. Let me read a couple of those, and then I'll talk about why they were disturbing to me. This one is called Hammer is the Prayer. Mm. There is no consolation in the thought of God, he said, slamming another nail in another house another havoc had half taken. Grace is not consciousness, nor is it beyond. To hell with remembrance, to hell with heaven. Hammer is the prayer of the poor and the dying. And as wind in some lordless random comes to rest, and all the disquieted dust within, peace came to the hinterlands of our minds, too remote to know, but peace nonetheless. And this other one that I'll read, which sort of I think of as a fitting in with that, with Hammer is the Prayer, is called It Is Good to Sit Even a Rotting Body. It is good to sit even a rotting body in sunlight, uncompromised by God or lack of God. To see the bee beyond all the plundered flowers air stagger toward you, and like a delicate helicopter hover above your knee until it finds you to be not sweet, but at least not flinching. Its hair legs on the hair of your leg, silvering a coolness through you like a soul of nerve.
Tell us about this. It sounds like vitality rising, vitality falling, and sort of meeting in those hairy legs.
No, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, I think it's the soul as pure materiality at the end, rather than something immaterial, a soul of nerve. I think, you know, what disturbed me about these poems is that God is in a way thrust out of them. Any notion of heaven, an afterlife, a notion of God is thrust out of the poems. In fact, there's open contempt for the idea of heaven in the latter poem and the idea of some transcendent God in the former poem, in Hammer is the Prayer. And this disturbed me for a while. And there's other poems in the book that fit in with these. And I've had to think a lot about how they fit in with my work, and I was greatly helped when I came across a quote by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a great 20th century theologian who was German but died in a German prison during World War II, and he was executed. And he said, God calls us to be in the world without God. God calls us to exist in a world without God. You know, before God and with God, we stand in a world without God. I'm mangling the quote somewhat, but that's the notion. And that helped me a lot to think of these poems in that context, because I could think of them as sort of anti-devotional poems.
Mm.
You know, it's so difficult to write a devotional poem now because the language is so compromised, and even the word God is very difficult to use. And thinking of these poems in the context of Bonhoeffer's quote helped me to see them as aspects of devotion rather than repudiation of devotion.
Fascinating. I wish you'd read from that whole cluster of poems, starting maybe with Then I Slipped Into a Terror World. There are a lot of devotional, anti-devotional poems in that string. And they're all beautiful and mysterious.
Let me read these two together then. Then I slept into a terror world, and Lord is not a word. Then I slept into a terror world where things gave back my gaze. Baffled grass, a fury tree, dirt disinterring grief by means of me. I suffered a river's memories, rock's archaic ache, all the soft improvisations of the brain-shaped, breeze-shaped clouds. I was rifled, pilfered, praised, used. I was lifted up into the rain's mania, laid cadaverously down amid the avid seeps and intuitive roots, a little slime of life crawling through me like an inchoate, incarnate thought beyond God, beyond art, beyond all idea of beyond. Then I awoke with a start. Mm. This poem is called Lord is Not a Word. Lord is not a word. Song is not a salve. Suffer the child who lived on sunlight and solitude. Savor the man, craving earth like an aftertaste. To discover in one's hand two local stones the size of a dead man's eyes saves no one, but to fling them with a grace you did not know you knew, to bring them skimming, homing over blue, is to discover the river from which they came. Mild, merciful amnesia through which I've moved as through a blue atmosphere of almost and was. How is it now, like ruins unearthed by ruin, my childhood should rise? Lord, suffer me to sing these wounds by which I am made and marred. Savor this creature whose aloneness you ease and are.
That's beautiful. The aloneness that God eases, but that the Lord somehow gives us.
I think that's right. I mean, these poems are trying to get at what I think of as the wound of being. And my notion of God is there is some sacredness in the wound of being, and there is some integrity to it, wherein the presence of God doesn't heal necessarily or utterly remove that wound of being, except insofar as it participates in the wound of being. And I guess that's what I'm trying to get at there with savor this creature whose aloneness you ease and are, that God is, our experience of God is in some way a fundamental experience of loneliness. There is some ultimate loneliness that we go into to experience God, and yet paradoxically that intense lonely feeling eases itself. It answers itself in some way, and I'm describing a kind of mystical experience, I realize, but I am very sympathetic to mysticism, both within and without poetry, inside and outside of poetry. And there's some wonderful contemporary writers who get at this so much better than I can. Fanny Howe is a great example. I mean, her.
Christian Wyman, would you maybe conclude this series by reading Given a God More Playful?
Sure. And this is one of those poems that I was very happy to write. It's right in among the series of poems that we've been reading from, and I was very happy to write it because it is a completely different tone, and it lightens things up. And I hope that this book has a lot of moments like this. Given a God more playful. Given a God more playful, more safeful, less prone to unreachable peaks and silence at the heart of stone, I might have plundered thunder from a tick's back. I might have swigged existence from a tulip's bell and given all hell to a God who, given time, knew goddamn well what to do with it. Make and proliferate and vanish when you were through with it.
That's lovely. Could I ask you a question to the editor of Poetry Magazine?
Sure.
Everybody thinks, and some people worry about the state of the art of poetry or published work in general, books, words. As you see it from your perch in Chicago, I mean, what's up? What's happening? What's coming? What's stimulating? What's dampening the voice of poetry in our time?
You know, I think it's always one and one and one, like one at a time. I think these notions of movements come and go so quickly that they're almost irrelevant. There are wonderful poets writing right now. Atsuro Riley just published his first book, and I think he's almost 50 years old. But we published a lot of the book in Poetry Magazine, and it seems to me something genuinely new. And he's a half Japanese and half American, was raised in the Deep South. And you talk about somebody whose language gives you a sense of physical reality, just bubbling up to the surface of it. He's a great example. Ilya Kaminsky, a wonderful, very young poet who moved here from the Ukraine when he was 14. He's completely deaf. He taught himself English and writes in English. And he writes these strange, long poems that are also full of a very unorthodox kind of faith. Mm. But he's another great example of just a singular talent that's out there. And so I think you get these people who are around. I could name many other young poets. Brooklyn Copeland is a young poet we published recently who I think has a wonderful ear, and you'll be hearing a lot from her. But I think the movements are mostly just sort of bullshit. That we talk about post-avant or neo-formalism or things like this, and I think it's just a waste of time.
Christian Wyman, thank you so much. It's a privilege to discover your work in Every Riven Thing. It's a privilege to talk with you on Open Source. Can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much for having me, Christopher.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.